I can tell you now, it's a special case because I went from the beginning where the family was struggling, even though after we found a match, they were a dish of struggle. But, you know, once that patient went on stage and thanked that donor for saving his life, it's not only at that moment, but at every event that happens, I can say it could have been my sister who was thanking that donor now for saving her life.
Welcome to Career Cheat Code. In this podcast, you'll hear how everyday people impact the world through their careers, learn about their journey, career hacks, and obstacles along the way. Whether you're already having the impact you want or are searching for it, this is the podcast for you.
So, Iram, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Really appreciate you taking the time to connect. I know running an organization, you know, can pull you in many different directions. So, you know, really appreciative of you taking the time to do this today. Let's dive right in, though. Let's tell the world what it is you do for a living.
I save lives of patients whose only cure is a bone marrow transplant, and we do so by providing financial, logistical, and financial support for those patients whose only cure would be that treatment of receiving a bone marrow transplant. And it always started after my sister went through the process of trying to find a match, and now my family now came to this country trying to save her life. So today, now we, through our experience and our motivation to help others, we provide the services so that others now can go through treatment and hopefully receive the cure.
Yeah, and I'm very familiar with this story, but can you tell me what is your role and what is the name of your organization?
I'm currently the president and executive director of the ICLA da Silva Foundation, which was named after my sister, ICLA.
Got it. Okay, so that sounds like there's a story there. Let's start there. Let's start with, why does this foundation exist today?
Back in 1989, when we were living a very comfortable life in a beautiful beach in Brazil, my sister was taking dance classes. And after one of those classes, she started having pains in her legs and arms. And after running to the hospital in the middle of the night, when we woke up, when she was screaming in pain, she was diagnosed with chronic myelogenous leukemia. And the doctor said at the time that the only cure would be a bone marrow transplant. So she was 11 years old. And within 3 weeks of her diagnosis, my family decided to sell everything that we had in Brazil. My father was a very well-known chemist in the sugar and alcohol factory, but we had to sell everything that we had and came to New York, to Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, because at the time, in 1986, here in the United States, they started the National Marrow Donor Program that now is BeTheMatch. And MDP. And our hope was to find a match, since my brother and I was not a match to my sister. So after being tested in Brazil and finding out that there was no match, her only cure would be a bone marrow transplant. Memorial was one of the leading hospitals doing bone marrow transplants at the time. So we came here with the hopes of finding her a match and give her the best treatment we could find in the world. But unfortunately, when we arrived here, the doctor searched the national registry. There was no match as well. And we came to learn that now a person is more likely to match another person from the same racial ethnic background. And that's when it was suggested that we start a campaign within the Brazilian community in the United States. And we did not know how many Brazilians were here. But my family went to the Brazilian consulate and talked to them and learned more. And we were invited to start going, working together with the New York Blood Center to go to Newark, New Jersey, where there is a very large Brazilian population. And then churches and organizations start opening doors for us to do bone marrow platelets and bone marrow drives as well. And again, it was just at the beginning of the national registry. So there was a lot of known things that were not in place yet that we had to work to put in place. But to make a long story short, after 2 years of running bone marrow drives, some of the patients that we were so looking for a match in the registry found a match from the donors that we were recruiting. But unfortunately, my sister was never able to find a match. And she passed away at the age of 13 without finding that person who could give her her healthy life back.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that. I know you and I have spoken about this for a long time, but you know, it's one thing to acknowledge this in this type of forum. How old were you at this time?
Yeah, so when I arrived here, I was 13, and when she passed away, I was 15 years old.
Got it. Okay, so at this time, you are now fully settled in New York City. Your dad is no longer a chemist, I'm assuming, what were your parents doing at that time? How were you all settling into the States, aside from, you know, all the things that you were dealing with through health?
Yeah, no, definitely. You know, as you know, the treatment is very expensive. So because now the amount that we raise in Brazil with the exchange rate, you know, this money started running out after 1 year that we were here. So my dad had to start working as a taxi driver. I was attending, you know, school on Roosevelt Island. It's a small island. So I went to work delivering Chinese food at the time, you know, to make sure that we have enough food on the table, we're able to pay the bills. And then at that time, we were trying to, you know, make sure my sister had everything that she needed for her treatment. But you know, after she passed away, you know, we actually went back to Brazil because she, you know, she always wanted to go back. And after she passed away, we wanted to bring her body to rest there. But my dad had the appointment to close here. And also there was a very large bill in the hospital that he had to make sure that it gets paid. So when he got here and he met so many other families also asking for help and, you know, to find a bone marrow match. And that's when he decided to continue the work that he was doing recruiting bone marrow donors. We came back actually not until a year and a half later when my mother came to work at the Brazilian consulate. And I continued with my school. I was now at the time I was in high school and now international high school. I went first to Liberty High School and then Humanities High School to continue with my education while we were trying to settle our lives here in the U.S.
Wow. So, you know, this is unfortunately not an uncommon story where the family has to either uproot or completely turn everything around for the sake of trying to save one of their family members' lives. And sometimes it's successful, sometimes it's not. But as dedicated parents and family members, you do what you can, right? And you do as much as you can. So your family uprooted from, as you mentioned, you know, well-established jobs and careers there. So then coming here and trying to find odd jobs to make ends meet and try to foot that big hospital bill and the expenses of moving and all of the things that come with, as you know, just healthcare, right? So there are a lot of other costs associated with that, not just the hospital bill, right? Like you have to get to and from the hospital. You have to sometimes miss work to go and be there. You have to commute, you have to eat, you have to take care of the other children that are involved, right? Like yourself, and you were yourself trying to find another job at 15 at that age. So, you know, it's certainly a lot. I typically ask people if what they do now is what they always wanted to do for a living. I'm going to imagine the answer for you is no, but would love to hear if there was another career you had in mind at the time, or if you feel like kind of the universe just played its part in leading into this place here.
Yeah, you know, when I came here, as I mentioned, I was 13, and because we lived a very comfortable life in Brazil, for some reason, maybe my memory, I don't have recollection of thinking about what I want to do in life other than be with my friends, play in the beach. You know, it was, you know, beautiful beach that I used to live and, you know, go to school, play sports. And I really don't remember, to be sincere. However, through my sister's treatment and the days and nights and weekends that I spent here in the hospital and seeing what she was going through, and through the experience that I had knowing through the community to create awareness and education about bone marrow transplants, you know, that's when the idea of becoming a doctor came about. You know, it's many times, you know, because of personal experience, and we admire the profession. So that's when I would say probably when I was finishing, when I was in high school, that's when I started thinking about more, you know, biology and chemistry, and I'm going to medical school to find a cure for cancer or the leukemia. So that's the only time I started to think about, you know, becoming a doctor.
That makes sense. So you know, that seems like something that is intuitive, right? If you see your sister go through something, you're like, okay, well, how do I become part of the solution? How do I help that? Mm-hmm. So tell me about that process. So you're in high school and you're now, you know, you just lost your sister while still in high school. Mm-hmm. And you have to continue to go to school and you have to continue to figure out what you're going to do. So you're planning for medical college at that time, and then ultimately trying to go to medical school. Tell me what happens once you graduate high school.
While I was in high school, I was very involved in organizing blood drives. And it turns out that, you know, I received the, you know, humanitarian awards for Jimenez High School. And today, I believe even today is one of the high schools that has the largest blood drives in New York City. So all my semesters there. And as I prepared to go to college, now I started to take the AP biology, AP chemistry in my school, in high school. And then I remember talking to my guidance counselor. She was now always saying that it was very difficult for someone who was, you know, my English was still very, you know, not as good. And, you know, my grades was not the best because of the challenges. You know, I went to Jimenez High School and she mentioned that, you know, it would be very difficult for me to be accepted at a school that is like an Ivy League or even now SUNY Binghamton, for example, who was very known for you know, biology and science. But I went against, you know, her advice and ended up applying anyway. You know, she was encouraging me just to apply to, you know, city colleges or some of the other schools, which are amazing schools as well. But I decided to apply and I actually was accepted at Binghamton College University and as well as, you know, Stony Brook, which are a great science school. So, and that's where I ended up going to Binghamton University, upstate New York.
Yeah, so Binghamton, you know, I know well, so about 3.5-4 hours outside of the city.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you were nice, you know, and cold.
Yeah, oh, for sure. When the weather says it's going to snow for Monday, that's the weather for the rest of the week.
Yeah.
So, So you go out there, and at this point, was the Ecola da Silva Foundation formed already?
Yeah, so the foundation was founded exactly 1 year after she passed away. So she passed away in 1991, and in 1991, it was already established 501c3 nonprofit organization, and was my father was pretty much the one involved. I was helping as much as I could at the medal drives, carrying the boxes, giving out flyers, inviting people to join, you know, through the high school, organizing some blood drives as well to help, and only the senior class could join the registry because you have to be 18 to join the registry, but I was always very involved in helping as much as I could. But I was, of course, you know, finishing high school, starting college at the time.
So tell me why the Ecola da Silva Foundation was founded and what its intended purpose was in 1991.
First, even though my sister was only 12 years old, while she was in the hospital and waiting to find that compatible match, she always mentioned that after she was cured, she wanted to start a foundation to help those other patients that she met in the hospital and needed find a matching as well. Now, like I said, she was going on the PATH train to Newark, carrying the boxes to ask the community to join the registry. So she had a lot of experience on that, you know, participating, even though she was only 12 years old at the time. So she always mentioned she wants to start a foundation to help the other kids. Second, she also saw that some of the people that we were recruiting were matching with other patients. And those patients are now receiving a bone marrow transplant, saving their lives. And lastly, when my father was, you know, taking her room apart after she passed away, he found a little note saying, "Mom, I'm doing well. Please help my friends." And I don't know why she wrote that, but we imagine that what she was always mentioned, that she wants to help other kids. So with that, you know, my father had, and knowing all the patients that were asking him, you know, to continue the bone marrow drives, that's when the foundation, you know, started. So they decided to start a foundation and continue to work together with the New York Blood Center and the National Marrow Donor Program to create awareness, education, specifically on the ethnic diverse communities, because they were underrepresented in the registry. And so the main goal and mission was to create awareness, education, and add more ethnic diverse donors to the National Bone Marrow Registry.
Which makes sense, right? While you were hosting blood drives and bone marrow drives through high school. And then did you also do that through college?
Yeah, so throughout my 4 years of college, every semester was, you know, working with a school newspaper to write articles to create awareness. People know what bone marrow is to take away the fear, but also bone marrow drive. And many times during the week when I did not have class, I was not, you know, not playing sports, not hanging out with friends, but I was traveling up to New York to SUNY Albany and Cornell University to also host bone marrow drives. Because I knew that now every single person that joined the registry was a hope for a patient like my sister who never found a match. So when on weekends was always planning the next one and planning, you know, making calls and reaching out to other student groups, other college universities to continue to add as many donors as possible.
Okay, that makes sense. So, and even through this, right, in your mind, you're just doing this as something that is just part of you continuing your sister's legacy and doing this and trying to support others, but you're still going to school to try to be a doctor, right?
Yes, that was the goal. I was a biology major, then an economics minor at SUNY Binghamton. And, you know, I just know that my motivation was no longer my sister, of course, but I knew that I could not lose that fight. No, my enemy was the leukemia who took my sister's life away. And of course, I was still very young. I don't know what I had in mind, but I thought that if I continue to do what I was doing, all the kids or even adults like my sister was a child now not have to lose their life because there was not a donor. So I continued to do that through college and why I had to make sure I had good grades to go to medical school and make sure I had being at the university is a very, you know, competitive school as well, not as diverse in the past. So as when I first went there and there was challenge in terms of adapting to the environment, you know, to the school itself. But I did my best.
Okay, that makes sense. So tell me what happens upon graduation. What did you think was going to happen and what actually happened?
I started to realize, you know, maybe I was becoming a little bit more mature that, you know, what really took my sister's life from us was not because there was not good doctors. We came looking for the best doctors in the world in the bone marrow transplant, but it was because there was not enough people in the registry willing to donate bone marrow. People who are from our communities, now, especially from the ethnic diverse communities, we know that even for blood donation is not a common thing that many of our people in our community do. But I thought that just by creating that awareness, education, and inviting people to join the registry, I could be saving lives. And I saw year after year that the more donors we added to the registry, more patients were finding a match and receiving that transplant that my sister never had a chance to. So that's when I thought, I don't think that we need another doctor there who will be struggling to treat their patients because there's not a donor. So that's when I thought, you know, I would like to continue this work of working within the community, building relationships, bringing organizations, college, universities, students, young people on this movement to create awareness there that we all have the power to save a life. Simplifies learning more about bone marrow and joining the registry. And that's where I decided to, instead of going to medical school, I went to New York Medical College and to get a master's in public health so that I could continue working, you know, in the community, creating awareness and education. My thesis for my master's degree was about the need for diversity in the bone marrow registry. I was sharing how a registry that was growing had more than a few million donors already, but not enough African-American, Hispanic, Asian donors in the registry. And those communities was the one who were really struggling to receive a bone marrow transplant. So I thought that by dedicating the time, I would be giving equal access, same opportunity to all the communities that we could.
Well, so when you went to get that master's, were you already working? Did you already start full-time working at the foundation, or were you did you go straight to full-time master's?
Not yet. Now, what I had to do was, although I had student loans from Binghamton already, because my parents, my father, although he was working at the foundation for the first 7 years, he did not take any salary, you know, because the foundation was very small. So I had to go back and I had to work. So luckily, I was able to get a job at the Brazilian American Chamber of Commerce. They organize a major event. You know, it's a Person of the Year Awards. And I start work with the founder, especially during summertime. And then I used to commute to New York Medical College right after work. I went to school, graduate school at night to be able to get my degree. And by working there, I was able to not only pay my graduate school, but also start paying my student loans from Binghamton University. So throughout the 2 years of my graduate studies, you know, I was working full-time at the Chamber of Commerce to be able to, you know, not only for my personal expenses, but also to be able to pay for my education.
Well, that makes sense. So tell me about what master's degree did you get, and do you feel like it actually helped you in the way that you thought it would?
It was a master's degree in public health, with an emphasis on healthcare management and policy. It helped on learning a lot more about, you know, health management, but the work that we do, it's community, it's partnership and building relationships. I do know that a lot of the things that I learned in terms of, you know, healthcare finance and policy, I mean, it does help understand, you know, of course, I have worked throughout the years in trying to develop policies to now cover the cost of a bone marrow donor and the tick day off and many other areas. But I think that every, you know, education that we have, it always help in the process. But the work that we did was a lot, you know, working directly with the community, with the, you know, with the public to invite them to become bone marrow donors.
That makes sense. Okay. So you finish your master's degree now. You have all this new knowledge and understanding of how to apply those skills. Mm-hmm. At what point do you start thinking about kind of what is next after the Chamber of Commerce? What is next for you professionally? How can you actually dive into this head on and work on this cause?
Yeah. So even when I was in my last year of graduate school working at the Chamber of Commerce, although I was working there, I was always, you know, doing work, trying to schedule bone marrow drives, helping my dad at the foundation as much as I could. And then we saw the opportunity to really expand the work we're doing at the foundation. That's when my father said, why don't you come join me at the foundation so that we could, you know, work together to do more drives, bring more donors. And I did accept that invitation. However, I had to really, it was sacrificed the salary that I was receiving at the Chamber of Commerce, of course. It was more like a significant salary at the foundation, but my passion was really there. And that's when I joined him. We start working more with our board of directors. We had our first gala. It was actually our 10th anniversary gala at the time. It was at the Plaza Hotel, and we really wanted to focus a lot on fundraising. We started to build relationships with college universities, and recruitment just started taking off to a different level when we were bringing our volunteers, and the activities continued to expand until we got to a point that we needed more help.
Yeah. So how were you all operating at that point? Were you all applying for grants and getting support through that way? Were you just straight fundraising through things like the gala? Like, how were you like, at some point, bills do have to get paid, right? So how were you all still able to make ends meet during that time?
Yeah, so definitely. So the National Marrow Donor Program at that time found value of what we are doing, and we were organizing more activities than the New York Blood Center at the time. And we were relying a lot of New York Blood Center staff, you know, to be able to support all the activities. And they felt that we could become independent to be able to run the organization without relying on the New York Blood Center staff. So that's where we ended up having a fee-for-service agreement with the National Marrow Donor Program, where now we start to receive funding for the activities that we were organizing to bring more donors. So it was a fee-for-service based on the number of donors that we were recruiting. So with that, with the increased activity, we start to receive additional funding as well. And that's what allows now at the time for my father to start having a salary, for me to join the organization and have a salary as well. And we start to organize more activities and bringing value, you know, more donors to the registry. And that continued to expand throughout the years.
That makes sense. So if I understand this correctly, you know, the national registry has an incentive to diversify their registry because then more people would actually be able to utilize it, right? Mm-hmm. So they have partnerships with organizations like yourself, like mm-hmm. the Euclid DeSilva Foundation and like others to help recruit different pockets of population to have a larger registry, right? Because as you said, it is easier to match when you have similar ethnic backgrounds. Mm-hmm. So by partnering with you all and by providing you all with funding to provide that service, it in turn helps the registry ecosystem continue to grow.
Correct. And that was our main focus in our working with the Hispanic, Latino, and African-American and Brazilian community. Those are donors that was not well represented in the registry at the time.
Got it. Okay. Tell me about the point early on that you felt not just the impact that the organization was having, but a growth point that you felt like, you know what, this could actually be even bigger than myself mm-hmm. or my father imagined.
Yeah, with the activities that it started to develop, we saw that, you know, a lot more churches at the time, because at the time, you know, we used to recruit donors between 18 and 60 years old. Now, college, universities, student groups got more and more involved. We became, you know, a group that was bringing one of the largest number of donors in the country. Even though we started as a very small organization, now, my family trying to save my sister, but we start to bring the largest number of donors in the country then. And that's where we start to need more help. And I saw that, you know, not only sharing my personal story, my sister's story with the community, and so they understand what we do, but also the passion that we have in working with the patients at the time and others who were joining the registry. And the more as the year went by, we start getting more involved, because at one point we were not only recruiting donors, but then we start calling the donors as well. We start a new partnership with the National Registry that when a donor was identified as a potential match, now we also took the responsibility of contacting that donor and letting them know that they came out as a potential match to a patient. And now we start with the process of getting additional testing so they could move forward for donation. So the organization continued to grow.
What year is this?
This was probably 2004, 2005. And that's when the time that, you know, my family, my parents were really in a struggle with, you know, family relationships. And my mom decided to go back to Brazil, and my parents decided, you know, separating. And then my dad, you know, started a new family. That's when he decided to, you know, remove himself from the organization. And I continue. And that's when I needed the support from the board and support from, you know, additional staff. And mm-hmm. I start working with a number of volunteers. And, you know, I was able to bring someone, you know, Luciana Rodriguez, who, you know, joined us and was start doing, you know, filing and then bone marrow drives and then contact. She was the one responsible for contacting the donors. And also continued to grow within the organization until, you know, 2020 or so, moving, you know, forward, that we, at one point, we were bringing about 45,000 donors per year. And then we continue to expand. We were not only recruiting New York, New Jersey, but now we're recruiting in Boston, in Puerto Rico, because there was a little boy there that needed help finding a match, and the family was not finding an organization. So we start working with them. We organize a lot of mail drives there and start to expand to other, you know, cities, especially the very diverse cities such as, you know, Chicago, Texas, you know, California, and continue to bring more diversity to the registry as well, providing the support of contacting donors so that now we are using not only the culture, but also the language to make sure that those individuals were comfortable in moving forward with the donation.
in a way, like your organization has absolutely impacted the lives of thousands of people, right? When you when you talk about recruiting 45,000 a year at some point, right? Like that's 45,000 potential, right? Like potential receivers of a bone marrow that were not at all accounted for, and especially with the populations that you're talking about, right? Like a lot of diverse, underserved populations that normally would not be registered. I know you have impacted so many people's lives. Can you tell me the story of one or two that stick out for you that, you know, really hit home, that you're like, okay, this is, or maybe an early one that you felt like, you know what, this is why we're doing this?
Yes, no, definitely. Well, there are so many because, as you know, now every year we used to bring a patient and a donor to meet for the first time. But I mean, there was a case of a little boy, actually he's from here, Texas, who needed a bone marrow transplant and could not find a match. So we worked with the family, even being long distance when we were in New York, and explained to them about the need of bringing the community together to recruit more donors. And after working with him for about a year and a half, he was able to find a match. But there was another problem, which was, the insurance did not cover the cost of transplant. And that's where we said, well, we have to work with our network to make sure that this child now, because the transplant cost them $500,000 or more. And so we, with our support and working with the family, the family was able to connect with different doctors, and a clinical trial was found that could receive a transplant through a clinical trial. And then he actually received the transplant. And most importantly is that, just the fight that this family had, I could see what my family went through, even though they did not have to leave the country. But, just knowing that everything that I know, my family struggle, the language, understanding the starting the drives and going to the hospital and getting all the information, we now were able to provide that. I spent even today now hours on the phone now talking to patients as they have so many questions. Now we know that many times we go to the hospital and, it is limited time with the physicians, so the nurses. So that's something that we do now. So this patient was able to receive the transplant, a few years later. Usually they have to wait 1 year so they can meet the recipient. And we actually organized this event in New York, where one of our galas, where we were able to bring the patient, the donor, to meet for the first time. And I can tell you now, it's a special case because I went from the beginning where the family was struggling, even though after we found a match, they were additional struggle. But, once that patient went on stage and thanked that donor for saving his life, it's not only at that moment, but at every event that happens, I can say it could have been my sister who was thanking that donor for saving her life. So we knew that, whatever we were doing, some way, somehow, my sister is present. It's because of her, what she went through, or because her desire to help others that inspire, especially me, to do that. And then now that I'm doing it, I see that it is a process. It's something that is working, that it's happening, and lives are being saved. And, no matter where she is, no matter what belief we have, I believe that she's watching over us, and she's proud of the work that she came to this world with a mission. And I believe that the mission is here. And the mission is the Eco the Silver Foundation, and that's the support that we are providing. So in that specific case, it starts from scratch, from diagnosis to the struggle that my family went through, but also there was closure where the patient was able to receive a transplant, was able to meet the patient, and we're still in contact today, still attending our events. And it's just an amazing story that I continue to share and stay in contact with him, to be able to be alive.
Absolutely. And that, and as you said, right, that's one of many of these stories that you have, and people all of ages that need this. And you all were there for many years doing this. So can you, I know you and I know, but can you tell the world how you and I met?
Yes. So we were doing bone marrow drives, and I know that, of course, we expanded and we had some staff and employees working. And now I know you met one of our staff in New Jersey. And then as you're going through, you know, your own story that, you know, in your share that you also wanted to, I believe in the time that your son was, I think he was already getting ready to meet the donor. Is that correct?
Correct.
I don't have good recollection of that right now, but yeah. I believe he was getting ready to meet the donor, which is very special.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I'll share for those that don't know, but my sister was born with sickle cell anemia, which is a blood disorder that ended up taking her life at age 27. At the time, she had a 7-year-old boy who has since become my child. Since the moment she passed away. About a year and a half after her death, I was having conversations with the same medical team that treated my sister all her life, the same team that treated my now kid all of his life at that point. So I know that they have all the well intentions, are very much part of my family at this point. And they were telling us, my family, about a potential cure by going through a bone marrow transplant that would effectively take away his sickle cell disease. And after you go through losing someone at 27, you start thinking about, well, what does that mean for my kid now and his life expectancy, right? So you start thinking about that. And, you know, similar to your family story, right? Like, my family was in Dominican Republic. The only reason why we're in America is because my sister needed better healthcare, which was good and lasted for about 20 some odd years. So after going through that process, you know, a bunch of months of meetings of like just thinking about this makes sense. We decided, let's do it. Honestly, the only reason why we decided to formally do it was because the date that they said the transplant would happen on was on the same date that my sister passed away.
Oh, wow.
So I believe in the universe, and I'm like, there's no way that this is a coincidence of all the other 365 days. So let's just go with it and let's see what happens. Fast forward years later, he's super healthy, transplant great. He's great. But during that process, I got really interested in the stats around how much of an anomaly his case was, that he was matched really quickly. Because he was, he's a Dominican kid, and both parents, from both of his parents, like the odds of that were not as normal. And I got really intrigued by that. And I was like, wait, why? So I started hosting bone marrow drives at Columbia University, where I was working at the time, and just a couple of other pop-up ones. Then through speaking with a friend of mine, Tim, who had already been a bone marrow donor. He and I had this grandiose idea of breaking the bone marrow registry record. And we were like, how are we going to do this? So, you know, you and I had been in conversations, so we sat with you and we're like, this is what we want to do. We want to do pop-ups everywhere. We did not break that record at all, but the intentions were there. And we certainly recruited folks, and a couple of which have actually been called back since that have matched. So, you know, we have done really good things. Not the initial goal of breaking that record. But I say that because I think it's important to recognize the synergies between our lives and how paths cross, right? Like, I started just volunteering and doing things with you. And then after all that, about a year later, you were like, hey, Raddy, you know, we should talk about maybe having you on our board and getting more involved. So now it's been 4 years or so since we've been kind of in that capacity, 3 years or so. So, you know, I think it's just amazing to have people like you that have dedicated their careers, their lives to this impact, and have seen it happen in real life. And I've seen it. And even then, the thing with those bone marrow registries is you can get called years later. Like, my kid's donor, he said he signed up in college like 20 years ago. And he's like, wait, what? I'm matched with someone? I don't even remember doing this, right? So like, the folks that you have recruited, you may still get calls 20 years from now about lives. You know, I just wanted to share that because I think it's important for people to understand kind of how the network comes together. We'd love to hear about what Equal the Silver Foundation is doing now and how you all have pivoted, because you no longer focus on the bone marrow registry part. Instead, you do some other things.
Yeah, and I can talk a little bit, if it's okay, about that, because the great thing is that there were so many great people like Raddy that came to us, for example, saying, I want to break the world record of the number of donors joining the registry. That not only now today, the worldwide registry is a network of all the registry in the world is reaching 35 million donors, individuals who are willing to donate bone marrow. Not only that, there has been so many advances in medicine that patient does not need a 100% match to receive a bone marrow transplant. So a lot of our patients who were African-American, Hispanic, and Caucasian as well, that we were, some of them, we were doing bone marrow drives for 10 years. They all received the bone marrow transplant from their parents. And what I say today is that if my sister was here today, she would receive the transplant from my parents, or even myself or my brother, because that match does not need to be 100% anymore. So in the past, for example, an African-American had, I think, a 29% chance of finding a match in the registry. Now that percentage is up to 80%, and it's very compatible to a Caucasian. So because of the advanced medicine and research that has done that, in 2001, right after COVID, you know, we no longer needed to be have a very large network of individuals recruiting bone marrow donors. Not only that, they found that the best donors are those between the ages of 18 and 35. So as I mentioned in the beginning, we used to recruit donors between 18 and 60. So a lot of our drives were to churches. Now it's only between 18. To join the registry, you have to be between 18 and 35. So a lot of the activities are college universities. We do no longer have that now agreement or partnership with, you know, Be The Match, now where we used to recruit donors. And Be The Match, not only us, there were 19 groups that now it's more targeted campaigns at college universities and, you know, many different parts of the country as well. But we found something as we were learning about this and the advances in medicine, I said, what else is a barrier to patients? Now, since most of the patients now finds a match, why some of them, especially from low socioeconomic status or from the ethnic diverse background, are not receiving a transplant? What are some of the barriers? So we found that financial barriers is very, it's one of the things that now do not allow patients to receive a transplant. We know that 74% of cancer patients either skip or delay their care because of cost. And 24% of cancer patients file bankruptcy or they lose their home. Because it's not, although many do have insurance that they cover the treatment, but like we mentioned before, there is the cost of transportation, lodging, meals, you know, even rent. You know, and not everyone lives close to a transplant center. So in 2021, we review our mission and said, how can we remove those barriers for patients from, you know, low socioeconomic status, those that are below the 400% of the poverty level who cannot afford a cancer treatment, even though they have insurance? So that's what we do today. We work with an amazing community of supporters and donors and corporations and foundations that we raise funds. And we have partnered with 280 social workers from throughout the country, 150 hospitals that specialize in bone marrow transplant. And when they identify a patient that, for example, if there is a single mother with one child whose child was born with bone marrow failure and needs to go through a bone marrow transplant as the only cure. And I'm talking about a patient here, Valeria, who she, you know, found a match in the registry. She's not even one yet, but she has to go through this transplant. So her mom had to stop working to be able to care for her. And this period of time between the preparation for the transplant and all the medications and make sure she was ready for the transplant, it took 1 year. So she no longer could pay her rent. So she ended up, and she was spending all the time in the hospital. She brought all her luggage. She was pretty much leaving the hospital room. But the doctor said that she could only receive a transplant if she had a safe, clean place back home where she could go back so she could now continue living her healthy life. Mm-hmm. And that's when the social worker reached out to us and said, I have this patient who needs help. We have a bone marrow donor. She's receiving the treatment here. She's also having a lot of expenses with the meals. She's eating out here in the hospital every day. And then she needs to put a deposit so she has a place to go back since she lost her apartment already. Wow. And now the challenge is that, you know, when someone's going through this and there's a lot of needs, now, what the mom shared with us is that a lot of friends and family now kind of distance from her. and she could not find. And she not only we provided the financial assistance, but also the logistical and emotional. Our patient coordinator, Adriana, she's available. And the mom told us that she was calling Adriana every time she was in the hospital by herself and having a difficult time. And she called Adriana. Adriana encouraged her, talked to her. Everything's going to be well. We're going to be working together. So we provided the funds, and she was able to find a place that was clean and safe for the daughter. The transplant was scheduled, and she received the transplant. And she's very close to celebrating 2 years old and living out of the hospital now. And so this is one of the cases. So we provide financial assistance for lodging, patients who live upstate New York and coming down to the city for treatment, then they need to stay close to the hospital, or patients who travel long distance with gas, tolls, all those expenses when they are no longer working, or even if it's an adult, one of the husband or wives are no longer working, but also provide logistic and emotional support. And many times it's the utility, sometimes, especially in the Northeast, sometimes people are having a hard time paying the electrical bill or the heat, So all the expenses, out-of-pocket expenses related to due to the expenses of the treatment. So, and we do that within 60 days of the transplant. It's one of the criteria to receive support.
Wow, that is amazing, and it's absolutely needed. I'll tell you, just from my experience, when we underwent the bone marrow transplant process, it was a stem cell transplant process, right? We lived in the hospital for 52 days. So I'm going to outline some of the privileges that I had, right? Uh-huh. I was married, so there were two of us that were in the picture. We both were salaried employees, so we were able to take family medical leave time, and vacations, and we had really flexible work environments where people understood what we were going through. All of these things are not things that are a given by anyone, right? Our checks were the same through that entire time, right? So we could miss a month, but through our sick time, vacation time, we were fine financially. We had extended family, our broader family, including our parents, my sister's sister, our friends, and like that network that just kind of came together and took shifts and did things, right? That's not everyone's situation. And during that time, not just those 52 days, right? You're thinking about where you're living. You're thinking about commuting. You're thinking about food. The food that the kids eat have to be very clean. So you can't just order from any restaurant, especially for that first like year afterwards. So it's not just the 52 days that you're in the hospital. It's the year after that. Once you leave that 52nd day, we have to be back in the hospital 5 days a week for a couple of weeks. Then 4 days a week, then 3 days a week, then twice a week, then once a week for an entire year. At the time he was in school, he had to miss school for a year and get homeschooled, right? So there are a lot of like layers of things that have to happen through this entire process. The outcome is beautiful, at least in our case, was it's great. And like he no longer has to deal with that disease, but the process is strenuous. It strains on a lot of things in your family, right? So I appreciate that this organization is there that can alleviate some of those costs, because just in cabs and food alone, that's a big burden. So, and a big barrier for people to even consider having this as an option. And it is a shame that in this country, you have to sometimes make the decision of your kid's health and your economic situation, right? So I appreciate organizations like you that are like stepping up and filling that gap.
No, thank you. And it's important to remember that a lot of those patients, they are already receiving chemo treatment for 1 or 2 years until they are ready for a bone marrow transplant that is very intense. So by the time they get there, now a lot of the reserves has been exhausted, all the expenses has been increased, where now the income has decreased. That's why we are here, and we see, and we are definitely, the number of cards that are, thank you cards and message that I receive here are amazing, very encouraging. Not only that, some of them share, it was not that $1,000 that you helped me with my lodging, but just know that you guys care and the community that supports this organization. That's what it meant the world to us, because we have already exhausted our family and friends, and our organization, who does not even know me, comes and helped me make sure that that eviction letter that I received, I send it back without payment. And I'm not going to be evicted, and I'll have a place to stay after my transplant. That's very powerful. And we really try to listen to the patients. I personally, I'm on the phone with the patient all the time. They call, we receive an application, it's missing a document. We don't decline and send it back. We call them because we know what they are going through. Mm-hmm. Now, the last thing that they had think in a hospital when they're under receiving chemo is that, where is that bill, that heat bill that I have need help paying that is delayed already 2 or 3 months that they are saying they're going to cut my electric bill and I'm not going to have heat when I'm back home. Mm-hmm. So we really try to work and provide that, now not only financial, which is critical, but also the logistical support that we provide to them so that we, you know, holding their hands as much as we can. But this is only possible because, you know, all the generous donors and individuals that are helping us on a monthly donors, sometimes it's $10 a month, which makes a big difference. Just know that those patients, they need to eat lunch, or the caregiver needs to eat lunch at the hospital, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So at $10, you'll be covering your lunch, you're going to be covering your dinner. And it's about, you know, community, right? If you have, you know, 1,000, you know, people donating $10, it provides the support of those families. Of course, there are individuals who are donating $100 a month, or there are individuals who are donating $5,000 a year or $50,000 a year. So it's all about building community. And what we are asking everyone is that, would you consider sponsoring a family? We help patients between $500 and $1,000 each. Now, think about that. If you're able to provide your support, now you'll be sponsoring a family so they can go through this difficult time of transplant with your support. So the more individuals and now sponsors we have, now we're not talking about, you know, sponsors of $1 million sponsorship to develop research, but it's your $100, $1,000, $10,000. Now whatever you can donate, you'll be sponsoring a family. Now last year alone, now we're 750 patients and families that we provide financial assistance. And that's an increase from 250 from the year before. And now that the program is out there and very well known, we expect over 1,000 families reaching out to us. So that's why we need the support from everyone, as we did, you know, when my family here and we start running out of money. Now, Roosevelt Island community got together a group of residents, and in 15 days, they were able to raise $40,000 for my family. And that's what we are doing today. Now we are thinking about those less fortunate individuals who have been afflicted by a life-threatening disease and lending a hand to them and make sure they go through this, because there are so many patients that now celebrates life and celebrates with us. So that's why it's important that we bring support from all parts of life, you know.
Certainly. So we'll definitely make sure that we include the link in the description so folks can go in and just sign up. And as he said, you know, whatever your budget allows, if it's $10 a check or $10 a month or whatever that looks like, it goes a long way. Iram, I would like to, I have a few more questions for you. One, I like to prove to people that you don't have to sacrifice personal finances for the sake of impact. Can you give folks an understanding of what a president and executive director of an organization like this can make financially?
As a nonprofit, you know, it depends a lot on the range. You know, they are all size of nonprofits, and you know, depending on the role that you have as well. But, you know, I've been here 22 years, you know, with the organization. And of course, we have to take many different roles as not as executive director, but the IT, the fundraising, the development, you know, the all kinds of work I have to do, the marketing person. So, but with nonprofit, and it depends, you know, on the budget of the organization, they can range between the 90,000 per year and the upper, I know, 100,000, close to 200,000. It depends on the organization. You know, as if you ask about the president and CEO of our organization, a nonprofit, you know, there are millions of dollars organizations that the salary reached millions. But for organizations, you know, this size, you know, usually I have seen between, you know, $85,000 up to $250,000. So it's a very big range. It just, you know, doesn't mean much. But of course, it depends a lot on the organization. Now, like I said, you know, we have a lot of partnerships with social workers, and there are different activities that is involved and the funds that we raise. But that's what a nonprofit is all about, right? Doesn't matter how much we raise. You know, we have our fixed salaries. And one thing I can say that I'm very proud of our organization is that, you know, and that's usually how nonprofits are ranked, is that 80 cents of every dollar goes to programs, right? And then about, you know, 11% is administration and about 8% or so is fundraising. So that's something that is how nonprofits is ranked. It's now what percentage of every dollar actually goes to the programs of the organization. That's why I think that we now through Charity Navigator and all that, you know, we see that our organization is a platinum. It supports disclosure, you know, how we operate, where our funds come from, where our funds are going to.
Got it. How big is the organization now?
So right now we have a budget of about, you know, $700,000, you know, which of course it depends a lot. You know, we want to help as many patients as possible. So that's, we do requires a lot of more fundraising, but our goal is to reach $1 million by 2016 and be able to help about 1,000 patients.
And how many employees do you have in the team?
Three.
Got it. That's a lot of work for.
Yeah, we had two until half of last year, but because of the increase, we received 1,500 applications requests last year from all those 250 or so social workers. So we need to bring one more. But yes, and also not only is the program, but also it's our goal to raise, you know, the funds to be able to help the patients.
Are there any forms of media? This could be books, podcasts, newspapers, things that have helped you personally or professionally that you'd like to share?
Yeah, one that is very, I'm sure a lot of people who know, it's about emotional intelligence. I think it's very important, especially for the work that we do. And then when I first read the book, you know, it was very important to me to understand, you know, the emotions and be able to, you know, reflect and then understand others as well, especially when people are going through different, you know, challenges and ourselves as well. And, you know, in terms of movie, there was one, it's an old one from 2016, I think, is The Ultimate Gift. I don't know if you ever heard about. The message of the movie that really brought to me is that life itself and the experiences that we have in life is the most important value asset that we have. The movie is about a billionaire who was going to leave all his fortune to his kids, but he left in his testament that his child would have to go through different activities to really understand the value of life, and talk about, you know, the gift of work, for us to value the work we do, you know, and make sure that we appreciate the power of our job well done. He had to do all those activities. They understand the value and the true gift of life in order to receive all these funds that came from his dad. So, you know, through the lawyers, and, you know, the gift of money that, you know, by helping people who needs $300, $500, you know, before they had all this money, he was a wealthy family and they're just doing whatever. They did not understand what $300 would mean, you know, and the gift of problems. Now, how problems not only is something that we should avoid and how our parents should not just take away the problem from us, but we have to fight for it and be able to now resolve the problem, because we're going to be learning from each one of those. And you know, the gift of dreams. Now we need to dream with a sense of clarity and purpose that we have. So, I mean, it's a very old movie. I love movies that are life story. I'm not really much about, you know, Star Wars and all that. But now if you have a chance to watch it, it's definitely a life's lessons. And I know that, you know, everything that my family went through, that I went through, you know, we never gave up. And we always think not about what can we do for myself, but what can I do for others? And what not only helped me with, you know, keeping my sister's memory alive, but also is heal now that pain that I, you know, for losing my sister, and feel that, you know, if I can see one child alive and healthy, that's what it means the world to me. You know, there is a very famous quote that says, 100 years from now, as my car, the car I drive, the house I have, are never going to matter. What's going to matter is the difference that I made in a child's life. And even when I was in high school, I learned about that quote, and that stuck to my head. And it's so true. So, but yeah, I mean, if you haven't seen, definitely watch. And I would love to hear what you and everyone thinks about.
Awesome. I have not seen it, but I definitely will report back on that. That's awesome. Is there anything we have not covered today that the world should know about Iram?
Well, I can say that, you know, we all have the power to make a difference in other people's lives, especially save someone's life. it doesn't take much, you know, and anything that we can do for others and the benefit of others, it will definitely come back to us and benefit ourselves. So I think that if there is an organization that you want to get involved, we are one of them. And there are so many great organizations out there. But just think that, you know, it's by thinking of others that you're going to be helping yourself. You know, that's the main message that I want to leave, and get involved.
That's beautiful. Thank you. Well said. And thank you for taking the time to connect with us today.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did and believe on the mission we're on, please like, rate, and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you're using, and share this podcast with your friends and your networks. Make sure you follow us on Instagram and LinkedIn at Career Cheat Code, and tell us people or careers you would like to see highlighted. See you next week with some more cheat codes. Peace.